fumbled through the papers to find the photocopies. Oh yes, I see it. Why would he change his name completely? Who knows? Phillips shrugged. Perhaps he wanted something fancier. You have to give it to him. It does have a certain ring to it. A certain ring of madness, Anna muttered, as she thumbed through the papers. How about schooling? I can only see a record of his time at boarding school, which coincides with the same year he changed his name. There were no nursery or school records before then. How is that possible? Anna queried. Surely he would have attended a local primary school or something? Phillips lifted a shoulder. No doubt he's educated, so we assume there was either a blip in the records or he was homeschooled to a decent standard. It's a sorry state of affairs, love, but a lot of kids just fall through the gaps. Social services aren't overrun with staff and they weren't any better resourced 25 years ago. Anna tugged at her lower lip. Something feels off, she murmured. Shelford School is one of the premier boarding schools in the country. Why the sudden change at 16? And who paid for it? Was his mother well off? Phillips abandoned his own work for a moment to talk it through. We don't know much about Jenny Adams. He's never once spoken of her, or mentioned a father figure of any kind. Essentially, we know nothing about Ear Edwards until after the age of 16. For all the years when he was still little Charlie Adams, your guess is as good as mine. We did a full run on Jenny, but we don't know where they lived or what she did for a living. There aren't any income tax records or NIC contributions since the mid-80s, when she was living at home with her parents and working as a barmaid. They're now deceased. Anna wandered across to the kettle in the tiny kitchen, set it to boil, then turned to lean back against the kitchen counter. What about the hospital records, from when Jenny Adams gave birth? Surely they'd have made a note of her circumstances, of a father, of a home address. If they did, they don't have it on file anymore. We already checked all those things, when it all blew up the first time around. Like I say, the only thing we could dig up was that birth certificate and then the change of name document because they were both listed as public records. We have his school years at Shelford and all of his life as Ear Edwards the doctor, followed by his life as the hacker. Shelford might be able to give us a clue, Anna thought suddenly. They might be able to tell us who paid the bills. Maybe they'll have an address on file? Phillips rubbed his eyes. Ryan called them, back in the day. They refused to give out personal data, even with a warrant. They took it all the way to court, as I remember, and won on the grounds that it wasn't pertinent to Edward's prosecution. In fairness to the judge, it probably wasn't important then to know all about his family history so long as we could prove he killed those five women, but it's sure as hell important now. Anna stirred instant coffee into two flowery porcelain mugs with a thoughtful expression. Here's what strikes me as odd, she said, setting a steaming cup in front of Phillips. Why would Shelford School fight so hard not to give away the information? Surely, they would want to be seen to be cooperative with the police. Phillips took a sip, swilled the coffee in his mouth. You're right. It doesn't make sense. The light of battle began to shine in her dark brown eyes. You call Ryan and ask him to get a warrant for the release of records at Shelford. I'm going to ring the school administrator and see if I can't persuade them in the meantime. You're a force to be reckoned with and no mistake. You're not wrong, Frank. Ryan felt like the Christmas turkey, all trussed up in the shirt and tie he kept hanging in his locker in case of emergency situations such as the one he found himself facing now. He was seated in front of the window in Chief Constable Morrison's office and somebody had dragged a plant behind him so its half-dead leaves flapped against the back of his neck. A camera assistant fussed over him and tried to fiddle with his hair, but one ominous look had put a stop to that. The room was full of superfluous staff, nagging him to project an air of quiet authority without seeming too arrogant. Somebody who identified themselves as the new media liaison briefed him about what he could and couldn't say, as if this was his first time discussing an active investigation, or indeed his first time in front of the camera. Just before the cameras began to roll, Morrison requested that he stop glowering. Glowering? The newscaster for BBC Newcastle pouted, massaged her cheeks and made wider shapes with her mouth before she tossed her hair and made a little rolling signal to the cameraman. It was her first real break reporting on the biggest serial killer case for a decade, talking to a famously private detective who looked like he had just walked off a Hollywood film set. As far as ratings were concerned, it was gold dust. Ready? She didn't wait for Ryan's response but immediately dived into her pre-rehearsed introduction to the segment that would be shown on every news program available. 2 years ago, the people of the Northeast lived through a summer of terror while former Dr. Ear Edwards unleashed a brutal killing spree claiming the lives of five young, innocent women, before he was eventually stopped by one man, Chief Inspector Maxwell Finlay Ryan. In a tragic twist of fate, his own sister was the hacker's final victim. Stop. Ryan's voice cracked like a whip. I won't have my sister's memory used as a cheap way to boost your ratings, he ground out. His anger was cold and quiet. And you have an entire task force to thank for bringing Edwards to justice, not just me. I won't be party to this. The newscaster flushed an embarrassed shade of red and bristled in her chair. Morrison could see the situation becoming nuclear very quickly, so she stepped into the breach. I don't think it's necessary to rehash old news, she said firmly. Our agreement was to issue an appeal about the present investigation. The woman shot Ryan a look that was both wary and resentful, before firming her glossy lips and giving the motion to start rolling the camera again. It was remarkable, Ryan thought, how her face transformed into a caring facade, for all the world as if she gave two hoots about the lives of those who were lost. She began again, in the same serious, haunted tone as before whilst looking directly into the camera. 2 years ago, in the summer of 2014, the Northeast was terrorized by a series of brutal killings, all perpetrated by the same man. Formerly a doctor, Ear Edwards became known as the hacker thanks to the particularly vicious methods he used to torture, maim and kill five women before his killing spree was brought to an end by a task force headed by Detective Chief Inspector Maxwell Ryan, who joins us now. Ryan could have laughed. It all sounded so neat, so packaged, so far removed from the memories he carried of that last day. She turned in her seat and faced him. Chief Inspector, thank you so much for agreeing to talk to us today. She waited for some sort of polite rejoinder, but when none was forthcoming, she gritted her teeth and carried on. The hacker was imprisoned following his trial back in 2014, and the North has been preoccupied with other sensational crimes while he was incarcerated at HMP Frankland, the maximum security prison where he was supposed to spend the rest of his life. Little did any of us know that he had been hatching a plan to escape. Did you have any inkling that the hacker was capable of such a coup? Ryan detested her choice of words, but he answered the question. "Anything is possible, with enough money and connections," he said. There have been several high-profile helicopter escapes around the world, so he hasn't broken new ground there. Durham police have the investigation into his escape fully in hand. Morrison closed her eyes and was grateful that his nonchalance managed to project the impression that the prison service weren't at fault. It was a good start. From Ryan's perspective, his words were chosen in the full knowledge that Ear Edwards might be listening, whether on the radio or television. If that was the case, Ryan wanted him to know that he wasn't special, he was just another commonplace killer. "That is reassuring to know," the newscaster flicked a glance towards the camera again, entranced by her own reflection in the lens. "But these are worrying times, I'm sure you'll agree. Detective Inspector Denise McKenzie is still missing and presumed dead." "Nobody presumes she is dead," Ryan interrupted. "We assume that D.I. McKenzie is still very much alive. We are searching for her, night and day." His voice softened just in case, by some miracle, McKenzie should be listening too. He wanted her to know that she was not alone and she was not forgotten. "But, with the Hakos history," the newscaster persisted, "it's surely becoming less and less likely that your colleague will be found alive?" "Ear Edwards is a functioning psychopath," Ryan said simply. "He acts according to a specific plan, not in frenzy. He is intelligent and methodical, and I know he understands the value of keeping D.I. McKenzie alive in order to bargain with us." "Clever," Dr. Gregory thought later, when he saw the interview running on the evening news. Ryan managed to flatter Edward's ego at the same time as issuing a warning. "But, how do you explain the deaths of Bethany Finnegan, a mere girl of 15, and James Moffa, a well-known restaurateur and local businessman?" Sticky ground, Ryan thought. The death of Bethany Finnegan not only shattered her family and friends, but every member of Northumbria Cid and all the policemen and women of the neighboring forces who are working tirelessly to find her killer. "My heartfelt condolences go out to her mother, whom I've spoken to personally. I want to reiterate my promise to her and to tell her that Beth was and is important to all of us. It is my strong belief that her death followed a specific plan and that was to mimic the death of one of Edward's previous victims, Natalie Ryan. He would not say my sister. He wouldn't be able to continue, if he did. Edwards killed Bethany Finnegan to strike out at the officers who originally brought him to justice in 2014, and in particular me." The newscaster turned shocked eyes to the camera, then back to Ryan with excitement. "You believe the hackers' recent killings represent an elaborate vendetta against you and the task force who incarcerated him the first time around?" "Yes. That's what I believe." "How do you explain the death of James Moffa?" Ryan ran his tongue across his lower lip. "We are still in the process of investigating his murder and I cannot say for certain at this stage that Ear Edwards is responsible for his death. That being the case, I do not plan to comment further." The newscaster gave him a petulant look. "I understand that you would like to make a very personal appeal to the hacker, if he is listening." Ryan turned his flinty gray stare fully at the camera. "If Edwards happens to be listening to this interview, I want to give him one very important message. You've won. I'll say it again, you've won. I speak on behalf of all the constabularies in this region. In fact, across the country, as well as myself, when I say that you have demonstrated your superiority." Once again, Gregory smiled as he watched him play the right notes. You could have fled the country at any time. You could have killed Denise, our friend, whenever you wished. We know that and we respect it. Ryan leaned forward in his chair, speaking earnestly to the camera and whoever might hear him. I understand that your actions over the past week have been a demonstration of your power and we have failed to apprehend you. But now is the time to claim your prize. Ryan's voice became more persuasive, dripping like honey. Your anger is towards me, personally, as the man who put you in prison. I stopped you. I nearly killed you, as you nearly killed me. That gives us a connection and I understand that I am no better than you. Ryan thought the words would choke him but he forced them out. Let's stop wasting time and cut to the real fight, the real reason you're still hiding out in the Northeast. If it's me you want, Kia, then I invite you to call me directly on the number for the incident room and I will meet you at any place of your choosing, on the condition that you do not harm another person until then. You remain unvanquished, Ryan said, but for how long? Call me to find out. Ryan sat back and made a weary sweeping gesture with his hands, signaling for the camera crew to stop the tape. The room was buzzing with excitement as the journalists imagined the headlines they could spin, but Morrison stepped through the chattering crowd to put a slim hand on Ryan's tense shoulder. Thank you, she said. He rubbed a tired hand across his eyes. If that doesn't tempt him, I don't know what will. What happens now? Now, we wait. Chapter 23. Just before 6 o'clock, Anna stood beside the radio in the small kitchen of the Holiday Cottage, the paperwork forgotten. Her hands shook against the countertop as she listened to the news bulletin that had interrupted the constant stream of easy listening classics she and Phillips had been using to keep them company through their repetitive task. Did I just hear Ryan send out a challenge to Ear Edwards? She turned wide, horrified eyes towards Phillips and he hurried across the room to take her arms in a gentle grip. It's talk, lass, he tried to reassure her. It's fighting talk, to flush the man out. Ryan knows Edwards has an ego the size of a small planet and he's using it against him. He knows if he lays down a challenge, Edwards won't want to lose face. He's baiting him, that's all. Anna held a trembling hand to her lips. Frank, what if Edwards finds him? What if it isn't all talk and Ryan wants to face him, to risk everything to see it through to the bitter end? Phillips pulled her into his barrel chest for a bear hug and ran a hand over her head, much as he might have done his own daughter, if he'd ever had one. I don't know if I ever spoke to you about the last time, he said quietly, casting his mind back. But on the night Natalie Ryan died, I was nearly too late. Ryan had called for backup, but I was driving and in those days, we didn't have hands free. I had an old brick of a thing and we had clocked off our radios. I dropped him off at Wharf Square in the early hours and we were both exhausted. I carried on driving home, thinking that his sister would be there to look after him. We never thought. Phillips drew in a shuddering breath, filled with remorse. We never thought Edwards would stalk Natalie. It didn't fit the pattern of his crimes, but his intention was payback. He planned to kill Natalie in front of Ryan and he managed that much. He planned to kill Ryan next and, by rights, he should have. To this day, I don't know where Ryan found the strength. He was badly injured and souped up with sedatives. Anna knew that part of the story and the image of Ryan reduced to crawling, barely able to raise his head, was almost unbearable. He found the strength, Phillips continued, in the same quiet tone, while Anna rested her head on his shoulder and allowed herself to be held. God knows how, but he found the strength. By the time I got his message and rushed back, Natalie was dead and he had his hands around Edward's neck. The man had 4 broken ribs and his pretty face was smashed up. I've never seen that look on Ryan's face before or since. It was pure hatred, sheer animalistic hatred. In that moment, I believe Ryan could have killed him. Ryan always told me you stopped him, Anna whispered. No, lass. Wild horses couldn't have stopped him unless he'd wanted to be stopped. The fact is, Ryan just doesn't have it in him to kill, not in cold blood like that. He'd already overpowered Edwards and that was enough. Even through his pain and his grief, lying in a pool of his sister's blood, he still had enough humanity to step back. Anna let the tears come and held on tightly. That was back then, before he'd met you, Phillips added. He has a lot more to lose now. There's no way he'd sacrifice everything he has with you, the chance of a happy future, just to finish Ear Edwards. I hope you're right, Frank. The radio had been playing all day long. At some point, Mackenzie heard him walk along the landing corridor to stop and remove the cassette playing Pavarotti, but instead of unlocking her door to allow her the usual toilet break, or some measly scraps to eat, he had merely turned up the radio and walked away. She didn't know why today was different or why he had deviated from the usual prison routine, but she knew that it didn't bode well. Edwards never left food or water in her room. Whenever he brought her anything, she was required to eat and drink it straight away, and he removed the crockery afterward. Consequently, she hadn't drunk anything for hours, perhaps nearly 20 hours, and she had a pounding headache as well as a scratchy, dry mouth. She closed her eyes and did something she hadn't done in years, she meditated. Mackenzie had laughed at it before, putting it down as one of those new age, jingle-jangle, tie-dye fads. But as she forced her mind to drown out the deafening sound of the radio outside her door and asked it to ignore the clawing hunger in her stomach, she began to see what all the fuss had been about. In her mind, she walked along the beach at Cahardinyl, the village where she had been born in County Kerry in Ireland. She and Frank walked hand in hand along that bracing, windswept stretch of the Atlantic coast, arms swinging like a couple of teenagers. She smelled the sea air, she felt its breath against her face and the warmth of his rough palm clutching hers. The loud music was interrupted by a news bulletin. This is Mike McCauley's Drive Time Show. If you're just tuning in, we'll be playing 5 of your favorite power ballads, back to back, right after this important news bulletin, which was pre-recorded earlier today. Mackenzie's eyes flew open. She hadn't heard any news of the outside world in over a week, and she waited impatiently for the report before Edwards could come and turn it off. Chief Inspector, thank you so much for agreeing to talk to us today. These are worrying times. Detective Inspector Denise Mackenzie. Missing and presumed dead. The voice of a female reporter boomed into the hallway and through the door to Mackenzie's cell, where she listened with detached fascination as they spoke of her in the same way she had discussed the dead so many times before. When Ryan's voice followed, it was all she could do not to burst into hysterical tears at the welcome sound of it. Nobody presumes she is dead, he said, and his words rang out clearly. We are searching for her, night and day. Mackenzie started to sob uncontrollable tears of relief. They had not forgotten about her. Nobody presumes she is dead. We are searching for her, night and day. She held her head in her hands and listened to the remaining interview, hearing for the first time the names of the victims whose blood had covered Edward's clothing the previous two nights. She said a quiet prayer for the girl Bethany, who had died simply because she looked a certain way and Edwards needed somebody to kill. She even prayed for Jimmy Moffa's soul despite all he had done because, as Ryan had said that very morning, nobody deserves to die like that. Then she heard Edwards' footsteps charging upstairs. She braced herself against the bed and tried to hold Ryan's voice inside her head, to take it with her when she needed it the most. It was the closest thing she had to Frank, and she knew they would be working in partnership. Unexpectedly, she heard Edwards stop beside the radio, but he did not switch it off. He turned the volume back down to a manageable level as the interview drew to its conclusion and he heard the final, most important piece of Ryan's message. I want to tell him one very important message. You've won. Your actions over the past week have been a demonstration of your power. Now is the time to claim your prize. I stopped you. I nearly killed you, as you nearly killed me. That gives us a connection and I understand that I am no better than you. Mackenzie listened with bated breath, realizing that Ryan was bargaining with Edwards to keep her alive. If it's me you want, Kia, then I invite you to call me directly on the number for the incident room and I will meet you at any place of your choosing, on the condition that you do not harm another person until then. You remain unvanquished, but for how long? Call me to find out. There was a momentary pause before the radio presenter began again, recapping for listeners who had just tuned in. He was cut short as the radio was finally turned off and silence fell in the old farmhouse. Mackenzie pushed her worn-out body up from the bed and took up her usual position, in case Edwards decided to pay her a visit after all. Although Ryan had pitched his message exactly right, playing on Edwards' personality traits to perfection, it was impossible to know how he would react. As he had said once before, he could kill her any time he chose. Once again, she heard him move off down the hall, but this time he turned into one of the other bedrooms to drag an old chest of drawers out onto the landing, straining to wedge it against the locked door to block her inside. Then came the sound of his footsteps, quick and light on the stairs before she heard the front door open and close again. Mackenzie rushed to the tiny window and watched him stride around the edge of the house, towards the other side where she had found the worn pathway leading back towards the road. He must have hidden his car somewhere down there, she realized, and he was heading out. She sent up a final prayer, and this time it was for Ryan. Sir. Ryan spun around from the display board in the incident room, where he'd been adding a series of notes following his consultation with Dr. Gregory earlier in the day. He saw one of the telephone operators waving a feverish hand to attract his attention and hurried across the room. What is it? The operator covered the small mic attachment on his headset and simply said, "It's him." Ryan felt an odd little tremor, as if somebody were walking across his grave, but he motioned for the operator to hand over the headset and he slid into the chair instead. Nearby, people dropped what they were doing and gathered around to listen to the conversation. Before speaking, Ryan checked to make sure the call was being recorded and traced, then took a deep breath. This is Ryan. I received your invitation. It had been over a year since Ryan had last seen or heard from Keir Edwards. Even then, it had been within the safe confines of a prison interview suite, while the other man was handcuffed and guarded by two armed officers. It had been unpleasant to see him face to face again after the trial, but somehow listening to his voice at the other end of the telephone line was even more so. The medium lent a strange sort of intimacy to the situation, one that he could happily have done without. "So I see," Ryan replied. "I presume you're calling to arrange a meeting?" Edwards chuckled hoarsely. "Not so fast. Why ruin all my fun? I've always considered you a worthy opponent, Ryan, so don't disappoint me now. I'm ringing because I've decided to give you a clue." Ryan continued to listen, all the while watching Loison for any news of the caller's whereabouts. "Landline," the other mouthed, and immediately began running a search for its registered address. "You're getting sentimental," Ryan said aloud. "It isn't like you to want to play games. I think it's only fair to give you a sporting chance," Edwards snarled, gripping the telephone so tightly his knuckles turned white. "And there's a very big incentive for you to perform well in this little game." Ryan's stomach plummeted. "Oh? Do I get a certificate?" He tried to keep his voice strong, but it wavered because he knew what was coming next. "I will kill Denise McKenzie at 8 o'clock this evening if you do not arrive, unarmed and alone, to replace her. That gives you nearly 4 hours, Ryan. Plenty of time for a man of your capabilities, I should have thought." Ryan's eyes flew across to Loison, who scribbled a note on his pad to say, "Petrol station, cutaway heads. Tell me the clue." "It's very simple," Edwards said, with a laugh. "Just ask the wife of my first victim where to find me." "Your first victim was a young woman and she was unmarried." "It's a conundrum, then, isn't it?" Ryan heard his soft, malicious laughter down the line and he asked the most salient question. "How do I know McKenzie is still alive?" "You will have to take my word for it," Edwards replied silkily. "No offense, but your track record doesn't exactly inspire trust in our relationship." "Ouch," Edwards rasped. That really hurt. "If she's hurt, in any way." "Save your threats for somebody who cares," Edwards interjected. "The clock is ticking." With that, the line went dead. Chapter 24. Ryan made an immediate request for an armed response team to be sent to the petrol station at Cutaway Heads, but by the time they drove from the nearest police station to that remote spot, the hacker was long gone. At the petrol station, they found a young service assistant hunkered down behind the counter with blood streaming from a deep cut to his eye, courtesy of an angry-looking man who had walked into the empty shop and demanded to use their landline telephone. Evidently, the assistant hadn't noticed that the man bore a remarkable resemblance to a dangerous serial killer on the loose, whose image graced a poster on the wall right beside the till. It was a stark reminder of how unreliable eyewitness statements were, Ryan thought, because people rarely remembered the physical details of one person to the next, not even when there was a photograph to remind them. Thanks to a statement from Jimmy Moffa's housekeeper, Irene, they had already determined that a vintage 1929 Harley-Davidson 2-cam motorcycle had been stolen from the extensive selection of luxury vehicles in Moffa's garage. CCTV showed the stolen motorcycle making its way through the quiet streets of Darrah's Hall with a single male driver matching Edwards' description, along his favored route via the A69 to the Stifford roundabout and from there along the A68 towards Cutaway Heads. As before, the petrol station camera confirmed that the motorcycle had made a right turn into the Dales, but they had no way of knowing which direction he had taken from there. Being unfamiliar with two-wheeled vehicles, Ryan had deferred to Lowerson's superior knowledge of flash engines and was reliably informed that a Harley 2 Cam in good condition could easily sell for six figures at auction, owing to its rarity. It was not the choice of a shrinking violet, or indeed an obvious choice for a fugitive wishing to maintain a low profile, but it was certainly the perfect choice for someone like Ear Edwards. Looking at its classic lines on a computer screen, Ryan thought that the motorcycle was better suited to the Californian hills than the fells of the North Pennines, but, on the plus side, it was a very rare vehicle with a loud engine. There was every chance that Edwards would have been seen on his journey to and from the petrol station, but they simply didn't have the time to complete door-to-door inquiries. Edwards had issued a four-hour warning and that gave them very little time to spare, so Ryan asked local Durham police to canvass the area for a motorcycle matching the description while he and his team focused on deciphering Edwards' cryptic clue. But before all that, Ryan had an important call to make. Anna was speaking to the school administrator at Shelford, in Somerset, when Philip's mobile phone began to shrill. Noting the caller, he snatched it up immediately. "Well, lad? Any word?" Ryan didn't answer directly. "You saw the interview I gave? Morrison sprang it on me out of the blue. We heard it on the radio. It was good," Phillips said. "But Anna's worried about you offering yourself up like that." Ryan leaned his back against the whitewashed wall, next to a faded poster about mobile phone theft and another touting a forthcoming police comedy improv night. He didn't think it would be well attended. "Edwards is escalating," Ryan answered. "If you were thinking straight, he would never have killed Gimme Moffa. Now there's an army of violent criminals hell-bent on avenging his death and it makes no sense. Edwards must have known we would find out about Moffa's involvement, but there was no need to finish the man, not in such an obvious way. He did it because he needed to kill," Phillips guessed. "Yes," Ryan switched the phone to his other hand and closed his eyes, just for a moment. "There's something else, Frank. He killed Moffa's new bodyguard. It was the same one from the diner. Tony?" "Yeah?" Phillips inhaled sharply, thinking of how he had gone to school with Tony's father before he'd been killed in an accident on an oil rig. His only hope would have been for Tony to make something of himself and keep his widow company. Instead, the young man had become a stooge for a gangland boss and been killed on his first day on the job. He cleared his throat. "I warned him when I saw him there. I told him to go home." "I know you did," Ryan murmured. "There isn't anything more you could have done. Tony was a free agent and he knew the risks associated with a man like Moffa." "Aye, but it's sad, all the same." Ryan opened his eyes again and looked at the opposite side of the corridor, feeling numb. "There's something else, Frank. It's worse than Tony. Denise. She's..." "No. She's not dead, as far as we know," Ryan said quickly. "But I had a call from Edwards, less than 10 minutes ago. He's issued a deadline of 8 o'clock tonight. If I fail to show up wherever he's hiding out, alone and unarmed, he'll kill Denise." Phillips felt himself sway and he gripped the back of a chair for support. There was a short silence while Ryan listened to his friend breathe in and out, commanding his body to remain calm. What's being done? How can we find him?" "Edwards gave me a clue to finding him, but it seems like nonsense. he said I should ask the wife of his first victim. Phillips shook his head and tried to slow his irregular breathing so that he could concentrate on what Ryan was telling him. He moved across to the kitchen table and the stack of files there, rummaging with one hand until he found the one he was looking for. His first known victim was a woman called Isabel Harris. Phillips read out the name printed neatly on the front of the plain cardboard file, then flipped it open to see her face smiling back at him. She had been 22 and worked on the perfume counter at Phoenix, one of the oldest department stores in Newcastle. He followed her home one night after work, after he'd bought some aftershave from her counter earlier the same day. Seems he took a fancy to her. Ryan remembered listening to Edward's cold dissection of her attributes, as if she had been an object for him to do with as he chose. But Isabel Harris had been a young, heterosexual woman who hadn't been married with a wife. He's telling us she wasn't his first victim. Phillips sat down heavily at the kitchen table. We had a list of other potential victims we hadn't been able to pin on him, but a lot of those were crossed off when we investigated Paddy Donovan last year. Ryan pushed away from the wall to start pacing again, thinking back to another killer at another time. Yes, Donovan was credited with most of those. Even if he hadn't been, we come back to the same issue. Whether the victims were attributed to Donovan or Edwards, they were all dark-haired, young women who identified as heterosexual. We're looking for the wife of Edwards' first victim, so logic tells me the victim was male. They fell silent for a moment, then Ryan sighed. Faulkner is working his socks off to get those soil samples back to me so we can try to narrow the field, but it won't be enough to track down a specific address, only a more specific area. Have you found anything that might be useful? Is there anything at all we've missed? Ryan wished he didn't sound so desperate. Edwards has been careful, right from the start, Phillips replied. There's no mention anywhere of his life before the age of 16, of a family home address, or even somewhere he liked to go on holiday when he was a nipper. No mention of a traumatic experience on the fells around here or of a farm where he first learned how to kill chickens. Phillips broke off as Anna walked back into the room, looking vaguely triumphant. Just a second, we might have found something after all. Ryan waited while Phillips handed the receiver to Anna and felt a powerful wave of emotion wash over him when her soft voice came down the line. Ryan? Anna, he murmured. Have you got something for me? Maybe, she said. I've just had a long and interesting discussion with the administrator at Shelford School. The new administrator, I should say. Were they more forthcoming than the battle axe I spoke with 2 years ago? Now, don't get mad, Anna said. Where have I heard that before? He wondered, while he waited to hear what new mischief she had been up to. I decided to take a different approach, since I can't very well claim to be a police officer. When I rang, I said I was calling from the Information Commission and that we'd received a complaint the school had been giving out personal data about an infamous former student of theirs, Ear Edwards. Ryan waited for her to continue. Well, as you can imagine, the administrator was mortified. I told him, to make matters worse, we'd received the complaint from a private individual whose address had been given out and they'd been receiving hate mail since the manhunt started last week. There was obviously a new family living in Ear Edwards' former listed address, so I was calling to check that their old records were correct and to give them an informal warning. I suggested some refresher training for his staff at the school to ensure there weren't any further slip-ups in future. Ryan grinned at the empty corridor. You're a tough cookie. Needless to say, he cooperated. What was the address? His heart began to beat just a bit faster in anticipation of a fresh lead. I can hardly believe it, Anna said. But the address they have on file for Ear Edwards is Castle Drew. Ryan was shocked into silence for a full 10 seconds. Even with his limited knowledge of local history, he had heard of the Drew family. They were landed gentry and, until recently, their estate stretched across hundreds of acres through the North Pennines. If he's a member of the aristocracy, I'll eat my hat, he said roundly. But Castle Drew is right in the middle of our search area. Who lives there now? I already looked it up, Anna put in, delighted to be able to help. Lady Drew is still in residence. Then I'll need to have a chat with her, Ryan said decisively. Ryan, there's something else I found when I was looking into Shelford School. The Drew family are listed as benefactors and have been ever since the early 90s. Ryan nodded, finally beginning to feel the pieces slot into place. Which coincides with the time Edwards joined the school. Yes, Anna sensed Phillips pacing around the kitchen beside her. There's one final thing. The entire village of Blanklund is owned by the Lord Drew Trust. We noticed it yesterday and even the pub is named after him. I did a bit of research into the family history and when the last Lord Drew died, he left no heirs. Rather than the estate reverting to his wife, he left everything in trust for conservation purposes. Misogynist old git, Ryan remarked. What year did he die, and how? He was involved in an accident in 1992. Anna had already guessed the direction of Ryan's thoughts. He fell from the cliffs at High Force Waterfall after a late night hike and his body was recovered on the rocks the following morning. If Lord Drew was in any way connected to Edwards, the boy would have been 16 when he died. The same year Edwards changed his name and went off to school, hundreds of miles away, Ryan put in. Another coincidence. I'm betting his school fees were paid for by Lady Drew, which is why her address is listed on his record. It would also explain why Shelford fought tooth and nail not to let that information see the light of day when we were investigating 2 years ago. I could never understand why they kicked up such a fuss, but now I see they were protecting a wealthy benefactor. What is Lady Drew's situation? All I have is what I've been able to pull up from the internet, Anna said. According to the Lord Drew Trust's website, Lady Drew is permitted to live in the castle for the remainder of her life, but when she dies, it reverts to the trust. The question is why she paid for Edward's schooling, Ryan murmured. He has to be connected to her husband, who must have been Edward's father. What happens to her if an heir is found? He could be entitled to the castle and have a legitimate claim that the estate should have reverted to him, not to the trust. But Ryan, there's no mention of an heir, or at least no legitimate one. Does the Drew family have a motto? Ryan asked. Invictus Manio. Looks like we've found his first victim, Ryan said, and relief vibrated through his entire body. Here, finally, was the clue they had been waiting for. Tell Phillips to hang tight. I'll let him know when we've got a rendezvous point. It'll take some careful planning so that Edwards believes I'm going in alone. Please, please be careful, she begged him. I will, he promised. Chapter 25. 20 miles south of Blanklund, The medieval palace fortress of Castle Drew was surrounded by 200 acres of deer park spanning County Durham to the east, the North Pennines to the west, and the Wear and Derwent valleys to the north. Its foundations dated back over 1,000 years, and its walls and towers were so much a part of the verdant landscape that it seemed to Ryan that it had stepped straight out of a Turner painting. Ryan had telephoned the castle and asked to speak to its mistress, Lady Sophia de Jacquet Drew. Having suffered the ignominy of a double-barreled surname for his entire life, Ryan could hardly cast the first stone, but it had to be said that if there were a prize for the most ridiculously elaborate surname, hers was a real contender. Unfortunately, the lady herself was disinclined to talk to the police without her solicitor being present, and certainly not over the telephone. Ryan had made a supreme effort to appear sensitive and even deferential, but the prospect of a violent killer preparing to take another life was not enough to move her, and his patience wore thin. Time marched sickeningly onwards, and the skies were already turning a darker, cardinal blue as the sun fell lower in the sky, so he elected to override her protestations and drive out to the castle to make a personal appeal to her better nature. In times like these, Ryan felt he could draw upon his own family background in a manner he seldom chose to otherwise. It was embarrassing for him to admit that the Finley Ryans were listed in Debrett's and Who's Who. His own mother had formerly been a London debutante before meeting and marrying his father, a former British ambassador to France and a minor peer. He had attended the best schools and had called a stately manor house in Devonshire his childhood home. He even knew how to play polo, if he had to. Ryan didn't know who had been more uncomfortable when he had first confessed all of this to Anna, but he suspected it was him. With the kind of innate class that was nothing to do with title or breeding, Anna had taken less than 5 minutes to settle into comfortable conversation with his parents, to laugh with them and see them for the real people they were. They might not be perfect, he thought, with hindsight. He would not send any child of his away to boarding school, but they were good people. But then, he had always gone his own way, setting himself apart from what he considered to be the establishment. Perhaps it was why he preferred to be known simply as Ryan, because Maxwell was a reminder of a privileged childhood from which he now felt very far removed. However, as he steered his car along the beautiful tree-lined driveway through the acres of woodland leading to the main entrance of Castle Drew, he was thankful that his upbringing enabled him to cut through the usual hogwash that might intimidate somebody less familiar with the kind of exalted circles Lady Drew preferred to move in. Then again, he was fairly certain that Frank Phillips could have achieved the same result by sheer force of personality if he were there. Ryan completely ignored the liveried butler who emerged from the gatehouse to point an imperious finger towards the service entrance. Instead, he swerved his car under the archway of the gatehouse and into the main courtyard of the castle, coming to a stop outside its dramatic entrance portico. Shouldn't we have gone around the back? Lowison worried, glancing nervously towards the red-faced butler now hurrying across the courtyard. Bollocks to that, Ryan muttered. Stick with me, kid, and try to act snooty. Lowison affected an uppity tilt to his chin. How about this? Not bad, Ryan said, before slamming out of the car. Stop. Stop right there, young man. Ryan turned to glare at the puffed face of a butler in his late 40s, wearing a severely disapproving expression on his shiny, rounded face. It was mildly amusing to be referred to as a young man when there was only a handful of years between them, but it was just another example of the kind of ridiculous etiquette he hated. Ryan stared down his nose from a superior height of 5 or 6 inches. Detective Chief Inspector Finley Ryan and Detective Constable Lowerson to see Lady Drew, he said, with an imperious flick of his own wrist as he whipped out his warrant card. We are pressed for time, so we would like to see her immediately. Ryan turned to walk inside the castle. My lady has already declined an audience with you, the butler hurried to bar the entrance. If you persist in this harassing manner, I'll be forced to call the police. By all means, Ryan said. I was about to do the same thing, myself. Lowerson? The younger man stood to attention, dragging his jaw from the floor at the sight and sound of Ryan conversing in his most cultivated accent, with an aristocratic demeanor he had only seen in small doses before now. Yes, sir? Put a call through to the commissioner, Ryan turned back to the butler with a self-effacing smile. Norman will likely be at home at this hour but, thankfully, he's a close, personal friend. What should I tell him? Lowerson made as if to key in a number. Tell him to authorize a full tactical response team. I want the works, sniffer dogs, helicopter search, CSI team. It'll mean a lot of upheaval at this time of night and, of course, we'll need to notify the press. Now, just wait a minute, the butler looked between them. You have no authority to order a search of the castle. I will have the proper authority within the matter of minutes, Ryan said, in bored tones, holding out his hand to Lowerson while he made a pretend phone call. Is he on the line? There's really no need for you to disturb the commissioner, the butler interjected, with a pleading look towards Lowerson, who waited until Ryan bobbed his head like a Roman emperor before sliding the phone back into his coat pocket. Take us to see Lady Drew, Ryan snapped. The Right Honorable Sophia de Jacquet had been a plain-faced, mousy-haired girl of the best breeding and manners when she had made her debut into London society aged 18. It had taken 3 waltzes and 1 fumbling goodnight kiss for her to fall head over heels in love with Charles Drew, who had been several years older and under pressure from his mother to find a suitable wife. Having only known the stolen